Hello and hi, welcome to another Slice of Sci-Fi. I'm Summer Brooks, and my guests today are Rich Hanley and Lou Tambon, the raconteurs behind many of the recent publications from Sequart Books. The most two recent ones are Musing on Monsters, Observations on the World of Classic Horror, and From Bayou to Abyss, Examining John Constantine Hellblazer, both topics of which are near and dear to my heart. And I just have to say, did you get all of the monsters that you possibly could have been? I mean, how hard was it to find people to write about classic monsters, or was there just too much to choose from?
Lou?
Mm-hmm. It was not hard at all. Right. People love monsters. Writers love to write about monsters. The biggest challenge was having somebody pick their favorite one. So we had to scatter it around a little bit. Now, Rich knew immediately what he was going to do. I knew immediately what I was going to do. But we had to kind of divvy out the rest. And I think Rich had already taken care of a lot of that before I came on board, luckily. So Rich will tell you that story in a minute, I'm sure. But yeah, people, monsters, come on. Who doesn't love monsters?
So what was there a selection criteria for limiting or expanding which monsters to cover? Because these are mostly the creatures we are familiar with from horror on film and television and literature.
Well, the main criteria were that they had to be classic monsters, not modern. We didn't want to see slasher films. Mm-hmm. The main cutoff basically was the early 1970s. So from the beginning of cinema to the early 1970s, but then also classic television, classic literature, horror hosts on television, the old monster comics. And so in terms of people pitching, before, as Lou alluded to, before Lou was involved, it was originally me and Jim Beard. And this book was Jim Beard's idea. And then he had a personal tragedy that he had to deal with, the death of his wife. And then so Lou came in and took over, thankfully. And it was a very good pairing. But one thing Jim and I had done was get a number of the essays assigned. So beforehand, we already had for most of the Universal monsters. So we had the Wolfman and Dracula and Frankenstein's monster and so forth. Lou took on the Creature from the Black Lagoon. I took Godzilla pretty much from the moment that this book began, because I wasn't going to let anybody else have that one. But we had everything. We had essays about Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff. So it wasn't just the monsters, but also the people behind the scenes. There's an essay in there about the devil, because devil really is a classic movie monster, a classic television monster. Zombies, but the classic ones, not the fast moving ones that go after Rick Grimes. The Addams Family, the Munsters.
Don't forget the Wolfman.
I will never forget the Wolfman. Larry Talbot is near and dear to my heart, and Jim Beard was going to be writing that one. In fact, the genesis of this is that Jim wanted to do a book in which he could write about the Wolfman, and his wife was going to write about Dark Shadows. And so we needed to find people to cover both of those. Dark Shadows, in case you're not familiar with it, is a gothic soap opera from the mm-hmm. 60s. And that was Becky's favorite show, and Jim's favorite monster is Larry Talbot, the Wolfman. So we had people step in and cover those, and thankfully both hit it out of the park, so it worked out really well. Yeah. And
I have fond memories of Dark Shadows. I remember Barnabas Collins. I even, at one point in time, as a youngster, owned the Dark Shadows board game.
Yeah. Saw a picture of that an hour ago, weirdly enough. It went on my news feed.
I have no idea where it got off to, but I believe one of my aunts or uncles bought that for me, and I remember being so giddy getting that. I don't remember if I played it a lot. I think I remember just admiring the pictures and the game setup. I have no idea where it went. I would love to find out. I'd love to know what happened to it. But
I think that goes for a pretty penny these days.
Oh, don't tell me that.
Well, now it'll behoove you to go look for it.
Oh, possibly, possibly. So I do have a question. Mm-hmm. When you say your cutoff was the 70s, was Jaws included?
Jaws was not included.
Okay. Just had to
like very early 70s, because really we were talking about, you know, the cutoff being, we were really looking for like the 30s to the 60s, but there was some trickling in because the Showa era of Godzilla ended in the mid 70s. And there were a couple of other series that ended in the 70s. And so that was the exception. But really, we're looking 30. It was like the 30s to the 60s and then literature before that point.
Gotcha.
Well, but we did break the rule here and there, though, with the we covered the Monster Squad, though.
Yes. You should tell her about why we did that, because that was the one major exception we did, since that was an 80s movie. But there was a good reason for it.
Go ahead, Rich. You tell it.
No, you go ahead.
No, I insist.
Hell no.
Well, right around the time that we were almost done, our friend Greg Mitchell said, you know, I wish I'd known about this book. I would have pitched to it. And as it happened, we actually were able to fit one in. And he said, I'd love to write about the Monster Squad, which right off the bat violated the cardinal rule. But the Monster Squad is literally about being a monster kid. And the reason that this book exists is that Jim Beard wanted to do a book specifically about what it's like growing up as a monster kid. So like a lot of these essays are written from the standpoint of, these are things I grew up watching. You know, now as an adult, I'm discussing from a scholarly or amusing standpoint stuff I liked as a kid. And so we thought about it, Greg's essay being, you know, about a movie that actually is about monster kids and features the Universal Monsters. It was a perfect way to close the book.
Yeah. And the other tie in there is that a lot of this book deals with the concept of a shared universe and the Universal Monsters being the first, maybe it was unintentional or intentional, I don't know, but a shared universe where they started.
Well, an accidental shared universe.
Right. Mm-hmm. It was kind of like they had it, but
like,
they didn't.
Oops, really, we created a shared universe. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, here's a what shared universe. Thinking? We don't really care about it.
We don't care.
Whatever.
Half of what we're doing sucks and it's glorious. Yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah.
So a lot of the book deals with the universal stuff, you know, your Frankensteins, your mummies, your wolfmen, you know, all that kind of stuff.
So yeah. It was nice to close out with one final essay about that at the end. Yeah.
Wolfman's got nards.
Yeah. Good stuff. Good stuff.
And it was one of those things. It was a happy accident because we accidentally forgot to invite Greg. And I knew that he's written sci-fi monster movies, you know, I mean, movies for Sci-Fi Channel. You know, so I was like, why did I not think of him immediately? But it just so happened we had a slot at the end, and he pitched us something that was the perfect way to end the book. So it worked out well.
Yeah.
And you really cannot deny the influence that the original Universal Monsters had on monster movies, on the images of these monsters that got put onto film, onto television, and
onto our book cover.
Yeah. What was it?
Cover by Leia Battle, and it's beautiful.
It had been 10.
A little blurry, though. Maybe back it up just a little. There we go. Perfect. Yeah.
About 10, maybe even closer to 15 years ago, there was a book as a big coffee table book about the Universal Monsters, and it has all the, you know, black and white stills, photos from those movies, from the making of those movies. And there is a gorgeous, high resolution, black and white image of Frankenstein's monster on the front cover. And he's got this poignant look on his face that is just, it's one of those heartbreaking moments where you realize, you know, who's really the monster here. But the book is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this book seems like it would be a nice volume to set right beside that on one's bookshelf if you already have the Universal Monsters
book. I'm totally okay with everybody who owns that book buying this one, sure. In fact, I wholeheartedly endorse that notion. So
there you go. There you go. So of all of the monsters, you said, Rich, you said the Godzilla was near and dear to your heart. Mm-hmm. Did you find enough people to write about all of the other monsters that Godzilla took on during those years?
Well, I covered the Showa era, so the entire original run of movies I wrote about. And then I briefly touched on Gamera, but everything from the original Gojira up to the two Mechagodzilla films is covered. We didn't go beyond that because beyond that would be outside the scope of the book. So, and I also covered Mothra, Rodan, Varan. What else? Everything. Yeah, pretty much.
You hit a lot. I didn't even know.
I hit a lot. Yeah, pretty much everything from Toho that would fit into the Godzilla mythos.
There was so much in Rich's essay. I thought he was just making up stuff for a while.
He's on to me.
No. Rodan.
You asked about something we didn't cover, and I realized at the end that we hadn't covered Gamera, and it was a little embarrassing. So I threw some into the essay. I don't know how that happened. That should have been an obvious one.
I remember you feeling really bad about that. Like he's like sent me a message or something. He's like, "Oh my God, I can't believe I left it out." Oh,
yeah.
Like, all right,
I ended up adding a paragraph about Gamera, just, you know, because I felt like he deserved a presence in the book. Obviously it hasn't had the lasting impact of Godzilla, but it matters, you know, like there's a lot. It's got a big fandom, so yeah.
I was surprised to find that there are more fans out there of Gamera than Rodan, which is to me just baffling. I mean, yeah, okay, you know, Gamera is kind of intimidating in some of the older movies, but Rodan,
he's a turtle.
His wingspan is larger than Godzilla, and he just destroys, and he's glorious. And I think that's when I saw Rodan come out of the volcano in the trailer for the recent, you know, Godzilla.
I was very excited.
I almost wept.
I didn't think we'd actually get a modern day Rodan, so that was kind of cool.
Yes.
Rodan and Mothra are actually my favorite films in the whole series, and neither one of them features Godzilla. And I'm a Zilla fan, but those two are my favorites. So,
so Lou, which monsters are nearest and dearest to your heart?
Well, I did write about the Creature from the Black Lagoon, but I think that was more out of I think there was a gap there, and I said, "Oh, you know what? I'll take that one because I actually really do like the Creature in the Black Lagoon. There's just something about that film that I find I don't know what I find it, but it spoke to me a little bit. I just love the way it's shot, all the underwater stuff. It looks really beautiful today. It still holds up. But I think anybody could watch that film today and be impressed with it. The other two, not so much, but that one. For sure. But I also, like Rich, I'm a big fan of the Wolfman. We each mentioned him somewhere in the book, I'm pretty sure. But I know I mentioned him in the afterword as well. And I'm a fan of that concept that inside each of us, there are always two struggling. And that's just really something that I've always thought about, even when I was younger. There's always two sides to, you know, they say there's two sides to every story. There's two sides to every person. You know, you act a different way when you're with different people sometimes, and you don't know why. And there's just something in that. And the Wolfman, I think, really takes that concept and runs with it metaphorically. Yeah. I don't know if that was intentional or not, but it really does work. So
I have a feeling it was intentional because I think it comes across really well. If it had been an accident, that would be pretty phenomenal. The other one is Jekyll and Hyde is, of course, the other classic idea one and one. And while there's no Jekyll and Hyde essay, Jekyll and Hyde is one of the storylines in Dark Shadows, so it is covered in that.
It's slightly covered. We didn't cover much of the we had a discussion, speaking of monsters that didn't get covered. It wasn't really a monster, but it was Universal. We talked about the Invisible Man stuff, but we decided that the Invisible Man was actually just a man and not so much a monster.
And the Hunchback of Notre Dame is arguably not a monster at all. So so there were certain Universal monsters that didn't really fall into the idea of being monsters. They're part of the Universal Monsters franchise, but they're not monstrous. So right.
So when you were picking monsters to not include that fell within your chronological timeline, your chronological limits, other than being humans who were transformed, like you said, the Invisible Man didn't count, Hunchback of Notre Dame didn't count, were there others that were sort of on that borderline for you?
Honestly, Lou, I don't think so, right? I mean, really, because it wasn't like we actively set out to say exclude anything. And in fact, there is an essay about Universal's timeline that mentions both, that discusses both the Hunchback and Invisible Man, but in the context of the fact that they're not monsters. So I don't know that we ever actively set out to exclude anything unless it was post-classic. That was really the big thing. Like, if anybody had recommended doing an essay on Jason Voorhees, I'm pretty sure we would have said no. Otherwise, we were looking more to be inclusionary than exclusionary. I think because at least we had pretty good guidelines for what to pitch, so we didn't really need to exclude anything. It was, the guidelines were make it a classic movie monster, no slashers. And so pretty much everything people pitched fit. So it worked.
Which literary monsters got covered, ones who've maybe been overlooked by Hollywood?
Well, in terms of literature, the obvious ones, and there's stuff in there about both Frankenstein and Dracula. Mm. The length of the book limited how much we could do literary-wise, but what were you going to say?
Oh, I was going to say, we did mention cat people. So those were all... So, there's an essay on cat people, which I was surprised that got pitched. And I was very, very happy with the essay, actually.
Yeah. It's one of my favorites, actually.
Yeah, it's really, really great. Karina Bechko did it. And
Karina's written for a number of the books now, and she always pitches out of the box essays. I never know what she's going to pitch, and I love it every time. So Cat was great because it fell outside of what we were expecting to receive. I'm looking over the list of answers, titles now to see if what else would fit what you're asking.
I would say
The Horror Comics of Warren Publishing. I mean, I know that not everybody would say that magazines and comics are literature, but I would argue that they're in that wheelhouse. And that's a great essay about the old Warren Publishing titles.
Yeah,
dude, I would throw EC Comics in there.
I remember that in my introduction, I discussed a bit about Varney the Vampire.
I don't know who that is.
Well, Varney the Vampire should be a household name, but is not. It's a classic novel, predates Dracula, and it's one of the very first pieces of vampire fiction. It's not great, but it's interesting to read. And it set up a lot of the tropes that we mistakenly attribute to characters like Dracula or Barnabas or even Angel. It actually a lot of them predate it. They're in the book Varney the Vampire. Unfortunately, because of Barney the Dinosaur, it's very hard to say Varney the Vampire now and not sound ridiculous. But it's and Barney, by the way, is not in the book.
Well, that's
Varney, yes. Barney, no.
Well, I think Joe's essay also kind of goes into a literary area.
Yes.
Count that, the Bible.
Because it's biblical, yes. He approaches it from that standpoint, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. So I think we actually already answered this, but for each of you, which was your favorite essay in the volume that you didn't write?
Oh, well, that's so... Dangerous question.
I'm gonna
Okay, then look. which make it easier? Which one surprised you the most?
Well, definitely the one I mentioned, Corinne, is about cat people. I was pleasantly surprised on that because I didn't know much about cat people at all. And that was fun. I also really enjoyed Kelly Fitzpatrick's Frankenstein essay. We've worked with her a number of times, and I think Rich will agree with me. She never disappoints. It's always a fantastic piece. Mm-hmm. Everybody brought their game in this book, though. I'm going to tell you, I don't know.
I have to ask, have you since corrected that gap in your knowledge and have watched both versions of Cat People, the movies?
No, I did not. But
Agree with you that both versions are worth watching. Yeah,
I need to watch them. I felt like I had already seen them after reading the essays, but I do need to watch them. But what I did do actually was, as soon as we were done with our first drafts, I would say I started to actually watch the Universal stuff from the beginning to the end, and that was a fun journey. I recommend that to anybody. Starting with Phantom of the Opera and Hunchback, and going all the way through to not like a lot of the B movie stuff, just the monster stuff.
Yeah, oh, and Wikipedia, what to read them in? Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Like, I had never seen films like Dracula's Daughter before, and I thought it was fantastic.
That's a good movie.
Great stuff. I mean, and he's not even in it, right? I was thinking, sequel to Dracula, and it's called Dracula's Daughter, but wow, is it really good. I was very surprised by a lot of those films that I saw.
One that I want to bring up because it fits into your question about literary that both Lou and I just totally overlooked a minute ago, but it also fits into the question of surprising, is that our friend Joe wrote an article about how when he was a child he had read a book of short stories aimed at juvenile audience, and it had launched him into a career in writing and a lifetime as a horror aficionado, and how as an adult he tracked down the elementary school library and found the actual book. So so it was pretty wild. It's this collection of short stories that meant so much to him that it made him a writer. And he now owns the actual copy from the library from when he was a child in the 70s. And because the principal thought this was so cool that he said, keep it. Yeah, there
and there's a picture of it. Cool.
Yep. So that was a surprising thing. And the funny thing is, much like with the Monster Squad, that pitch came at the very end because Joe had written an essay about how some of the best stories in film and television are about the devil. And then at the very end, he said, hey, what do you think of this? And Lou and I were like, ooh, yeah, let's just throw that in there. So both Greg and Joe at the very last second were writing these essays that neither one of us expected would be in the book.
Yeah.
A year in planning, and these were never on our lineup. And the funny thing is, they ended up being the essays that opened and closed the book, because weirdly enough, we were planning this book for a year. We were totally lacking the essays that ended up being the ones that we thought were a perfect introduction, an essay about an actual monster kid, Joe as a kid, and then a book about what it's like to watch a movie about monster kids. And like, here we are putting a book out about the original title of the book, if I remember correctly, Jim's original title was I Was a Teenage Monster Kid. And it ended up becoming Musing on Monsters. But the idea that at the very last second, two people pitched us essays about actual monster kids was, you know, that was great synchronicity. And then we said, why do we not have that in there to begin with? What's wrong with us? But it worked out perfectly. Yeah.
Nice. Very nice. But yeah, because I guess technically I am a monster kid first, because I discovered horror before I discovered science fiction. I mean, I was 10 years old when I saw Jaws on the big screen, and I was thrilled. I was completely, completely thrilled. And then sometime later, I saw It Lives, and then I saw The Omen.
Oh, yeah.
And then I saw Creature from the Black Lagoon. And Creature from the Black Lagoon was the only one that actually scared me at the time. And it took me years, because when I saw Swamp Thing, I was both attracted and repelled. It took me years to get up the courage to read Swamp Thing, because it reminded me of Creature of the Black Lagoon, and I was still a little bit afraid.
Of all the movies to traumatize you, that's kind of, yeah, it's interesting.
I mean, you figure Jaws would have done that. Nope, it was Black Lagoon. And so to segue, since we're talking Swamp Thing, your other book is about John Constantine Hellblazer from Bayou to Abyss. And I love that guy.
Who doesn't?
I know. I was a fan of Hellblazer. And then the Constantine TV show showed up on NBC in, I think, 2013, 2014-ish. And I was completely delighted and afraid, because the show was airing on NBC, and that was the wrong network from it. I said that show either needed to be on Sci-Fi Channel or the CW, and it disappeared. But we still kept getting Matt Ryan showing up as John in some of the DC Universe shows. And then, what was it, last year? No, it was not last year. Last year was pandemic year. The year before that, he shows up in an episode of Lucifer. And I was completely giddy about that. And so how did talking about Hellblazer, putting together a collection of stories about John, come together?
Well, let's see. I'm trying to think of the genesis of this. The dark genesis of this for you Swamp Thing fans. Basically, yeah, it goes back to, I know what it was now. I was having a conversation with Julian Darius at Sequart about the fact that I didn't grow up a comic book fan, but I largely became one because of Alan Moore. And because I had been reading Alan Moore's earlier work, my friend Joe Bongiorno forced me to read Swamp Thing. Mm-hmm. And he kept swearing. At gunpoint, yes. It was terrifying.
Not really.
And because I had grown up, I had seen the USA television series and the classic movies, and I couldn't take it that seriously. Not that they're terrible, it didn't appeal to me that I'd want to read hundreds of comic books about what I thought was that character. Turns out neither the movie nor the TV series did really any justice to it. But so he kept telling me, no, trust me, you're going to love this. And not only did I love it, I read it a second time the moment I finished, and then started tracking down Hellblazer because I went crazy, as you see behind me. And so I had said to Julian, if I were going to do a book specifically about, you know, about one of the big two, I would love to write about Hellblazer. And and Lou came along for the ride, which was great, and because he knows John too, and not personally, they're just friends.
The rumors are untrue.
Yeah, they're just platonic. And you know, it's funny, you mentioned Matt Ryan. I think he's fantastic. I really love him in the role, and it's going to be hard for me to see anybody else playing him when anyone else comes along and plays him. And I'll be open to it, but he's just so good in the role that he is what I always pictured in my head as John. Even when the writing isn't always there to back him up, he is perfect.
Yes, I fell in love with him from that first episode, and I was like, he's the guy. He's who I hear in my head when I was reading the Hellblazer comics. So, you know, I'd always borrow them from a friend. I haven't owned them until recently, but he was the attitude is there. And
he's in the post Alan Moore run, because he's very Sting like in the beginning, but after Alan Moore, it's pretty much Matt Ryan from that point on. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the Justice League Dark animated films that DC has put out, I think there's two of them, he voices John in those, and it is a joy. It is a joy and a balm to my soul. And like you said, I would have a hard time embracing a different actor as John. But since they are talking about a new Constantine series that would be on the CW following his exploits on Legends of Tomorrow, and he is supposedly on board for that, I would be very, very happy to see that happen. But
if they wrap up the loose ends from the old TV show, if they do it.
I hope they do. I really hope they do. And this book, what were the instructions you sent out to the writers for this collection?
It's been a couple of years. Do you remember what we specifically said?
No, I don't think we had rules. I think it was just
no rules. It's John.
Give us your opinions and we'll see what happens. Yeah. And it was another one of those rare things where everything just kind of fell into place. We didn't have two people pitching the same thing and it just kind of worked out.
A couple of people who wanted to talk about the Keanu Reeves film, but they were enough of a difference in the tone that it was okay.
Okay. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think when I'm looking back, I remember that we specifically said anything that involved John was fair game. So anything starting with the Alan Moore run forward, whether it be television, whether it be movies, whether it be cartoons, we wanted to see everything covered. And for the most part, we got pretty close. I mean, the animated shows are in there, the Arrowverse is in there, the classic run of Swamp Thing is in there, the original Hellblazer, the post New 52 stuff's in there. So it's all pretty well covered. And then there are essays about Chaz and so forth. You know, there's stuff, there's a lot of different angles. There's a great essay, from my friend, Abe Brown, about London being a character in Swamp Thing. That's a great angle. That was interesting.
That was really good.
And London is basically a character in the comic. So in fact, literally, actually, later in the run, London's alive, you know, so it's, what were you going to say?
I was going to say the essay about the women of Constantine.
Constantine, yes, exactly.
Yep.
Yeah, despite what they say on screen, it's Constantine, but yes.
There's a wonderful essay in the book, Doug, that's about how you're supposed to pronounce it Constantine and not
really. Yep.
This is
Lou's essay, so I'll let him explain it because he's absolutely right.
Well, no, he's definitely right. The comics, mm-hmm. It was always specified that it was Constantine, but as soon as he showed up on TV, actually, you know, it became Constantine.
The Reeves movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the movie that screwed everything in that regard. Yeah.
Yep.
So go ahead, Lou.
No, that was, you hit it on the head there. Yeah, absolutely. And I try to explain it away a little bit, like maybe try to figure out the mystery of what happened. Like, how did it turn from one to the other? I go through some of the original pronunciations and I compare with some other genre film misrepresentations of pronouncing things. Like, how do you pronounce, before there were Lord of the Rings films, how did you pronounce half of those names, right? Yeah, right. Like, names are ridiculous. And then you see a film and then someone pronounces it a certain way and you go, oh, that's how you say it. I've been saying it wrong for, you know, however many years. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, there's some, I tried to just have a little fun with it. I wasn't being very super serious, but I wanted to get that out there because if you talk to some of the folks across the pond, they're very adamant about it. And there are a lot of clubs and groups and fan groups out there who get very, very annoyed if they hear, you know, the silly Americans talking about it the wrong way, pronouncing it the wrong way.
Yep.
So, it's a thing. It's a thing.
It's a thing.
Tried not to make it too serious, but I wanted to just, we felt it should be represented. I think when I sent it, I asked Rich if that would be a good idea. He was like, oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. That and the butt tattoo are a great way to bring humor into the book, because Hellblazer may have been about death and devastation and plagues and curses, but the truth is it was also hilarious.
Yeah.
And so having a sense of humor is important. And the essays, like, and there's a lot of essays in this one. It's a pretty big book, but there was room because of the number of essays. There was room to be able to do some whimsical ones that are just pretty funny to read. I was also pretty proud of the fact that we have Jamie Delano writing the foreword. That was a coup right there. Hellblazer creator wrote the foreword of the book.
That was very, very... What did we say, Rich? It was like, come on, let's ask him. And you're like, oh, I don't think he'll ever do this. Oh, come on, we'll ask him anyway. And we just, I don't know, even how did we find him? Through a friend?
Well, what happened, one of the writers of the book had said, I can put you in touch with Delano if you want. Yeah. And we were like, yeah, he's going to write out. He doesn't know from Adam. Like, he's going to do this. And it turns out that he not only did he say yes, but he wrote a great piece, basically apologizing to John, hoping there were no hard feelings about how he wrote him and the fact that he left. It was a great piece. Yeah. It really was
awesome. Yeah. And he was so friendly and so nice. Yes. Like,
work extremely. Ego at all. Just a nice guy. You didn't get the feeling that this was Hellblazer's creator. You got the feeling this was just some guy you were working with. And that's always nice to see. You know, you've been around in the industry long enough, you work with some people where you go, wow, that person's wow. But then, you know, so it's gratifying because you meet someone like Jamie Delano and you go, no, this is a really nice person. Like, at no point is he treating people, you know, like they're beneath him. And he could at his stage in the career. So it's nice to see.
Yeah. He was super, super cool.
It's a fun forward too. Like, I like things like that. Things that you don't expect him to write it to John. You know, that was cute. We had a couple other, like, the fact that the comics can get political was the nature of one of the essays. I mean, it starts off, obviously Hellblazer starts off with John facing all sorts of emotional issues because of Margaret Thatcher and what's going on in London at the time. So politics is part of it. Not that it's a political book, because in today's climate, that might turn people off. It's not a political book. It's a specific essay about that. The fact of John's sexuality is another one that was a really good essay from James Wilkinson about the nature of John's bisexuality, how it emerged in the comics, and how it's been misperceived from the media standpoint. It was an interesting concept. I like the fact that he did that.
And that was I think one of those late editions where I said to you, hey, we didn't talk about this. And then you were like, uh-oh. Yeah. We found James pretty quickly, and he turned it over, really. Like, he turned it in pretty quickly. So we were close to deadline on that one, I think, right?
Yes. There's also a great piece from Papa Midnight that we enjoyed.
Yeah, that was
the comic, movie, and TV versions, exploring the differences between them.
Mm-hmm.
I did a piece about Hellblazer stories that were canceled, never published.
Oh yeah,
ooh, my personal collecting with comics of any franchise. I have always had a fascination with stuff that nobody ever saw, and so I tend to do a lot of research and find stuff that people can't read. So I thought it would be fun to write about that.
Well, that's a great thing to have in the book, anyway. You know, like, it's just, whether or not it was fun, I mean, I'm sure it was fun, but, like, it's just something very unique to have in that kind of a book. It's really great.
For people who don't have access to the, to now be able to know, you know, there's
what
a
was
whole,
there, yeah.
My God, there's so much stuff that was canceled. It's actually kind of tragic. When you when you read it, you're like, damn, we lost a lot of good material.
Is there, like, an actual list of those lost stories in, like, a bibliography, or is it actually in one of the essays?
Well, it's an essay that one of the essays I wrote is called "The Hell They Weren't," and it's a discussion of every Hellblazer based story that I'm aware of, that because I probably missed some, but every based story that I'm aware of that never came out. So I get into the history behind them, what I know of their story, like the story Shoot were lost tales for a long time and then eventually were actually produced. So I mentioned that, you know, things like that. So, like, if their status changed and they became non-lost, great. But I threw those in because for a long time they were. Alan Moore's Twilight of the Superheroes is something that's been online for a long time. So even though it's actually, I believe it is being published, from what I understand, it's actually going to be published in one of the upcoming DC omnibuses. And that's pretty amazing. Maybe it even has. I don't remember if it's actually come out or not yet. So, yeah, that's essay form, not just a bibliography. I'm just looking over the list, like the things that's religion is a big thing that's discovered, is discussed as well, because I mean, let's, you know, one of the aspects of Hellblazer is that it pretty much rips apart every single one of the religions, rips apart, dissects, and combines. So that was a good piece. You know, the thing about John Constantine and classic monsters, one of the things they have in common is that time goes on and new writers come aboard and write new stories involving these characters, and somehow they both stay non-stale. You know, they both manage to stay fun. As Lou alluded to before, you know, watching the entire Universal Monster story, or me with all the Godzilla films, yeah, there's going to be some crap along the way. And the same is true with Hellblazer. But it's remarkable how people can keep coming up with new stuff to say about them. And, you know, and our books, of course, too.
You also talk about, I don't know if it was, I forgot whose essay it was, but the fact that John was one of the only characters in the DC Comics who aged in real time up to a
certain. Yes.
And that was very, very interesting. And then also how he kind of lost that kind of lost its luster with the new 52 and all that. And they gave him a rebirth, and it was like, it's not the same, you know.
It's interesting too that you say that, because he was right alongside all the other DC characters who were staying 30 and yeah. fit. John was becoming 30, 40, 50, 60, and starting to look like a person who had been sleeping in an alleyway for 16 years. And, you know, and meanwhile, Green Arrow still looked like Green Arrow, you know. So, but that's what, that for me was one of the big appeals, was the fact that you could jump ahead 50 issues and John was now 5 years older. And, you know, he starts off in his 30s. We see his 40th birthday. We see him in a man in his 60s marrying a 19-year-old. And they talk about the fact that he's this weird old man marrying a 19-year-old. and, you know, I like that. I appreciated the fact that John got older. And I was disappointed when the new 52 took that away.
A lot of people were, I think.
I'm still cracking up at the fact that Delano wrote a Dear John letter.
You think he's going to give you two, you think like, okay, he's going to do it, he'll give us two paragraphs. No, he gave us something great, and I think it's it fit the book really well. I was just so happy. We Rich and I think both did happy dances when that came in.
Nice.
That was one of those books where we were really, as John would say, riding the synchronicity highway. I mean, every single time an essay came in on that book, we were like, damn, that was fun.
Yep.
You could tell we had the right people writing that book, because every single person who was writing for it, whether they were big names like Bob Greenberger or Jamie Delano, or you know, or people who were pretty new, because there were some new writers as well, they all had a real passion for Hellblazer, and it came across. And so every single topic really generated a great essay in that book. I was pretty proud of that one.
Nice. Yep. Well, I am going to encourage people to go find these books, because, like I said, I didn't find out about both of them until right before the holidays, and it just...
We apologize for that.
That's okay. I'll let you slide this time. But Musing on Monsters and From Bayou to Abyss are available, I'm going to guess, at your favorite retailers, and also at directly from Sequart. I'm not going to ask what you have planned next, because I want to be surprised. But where can people find you guys online to see what new trouble you are trying to get into?
Well, richhandley.com. And you can find me on Facebook as well under my name.
Yeah, I'm in same places, except mine's, you know, lewtambone.com, but also all the regular media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever the heck, you know, whatever you got, I'm on it.
You might also find me, you know, like sneaking around in people's bushes occasionally.
Mm. Yeah. That's
taking been a pictures problem. Of them.
That's been a problem recently. We don't want to talk about that on camera, though.
With or without the Michael Myers mask?
With. But not while reading a classic monsters book, because he's not a classic monster.
true. Well, we will have links to where people can like find you guys. My favorite place is the Dumpster Fire, that is known as Twitter. But Rich, Lou, thank you for sharing how these two wonderful books came into being.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi right after this.
Escape Pod is your destination for the best in modern short science fiction. Our intrepid crew of editors and hosts will bring you fun, thought-provoking, in-flight entertainment every week as the pod careens around the multiverse. In the mood for a classic? We've got Anson Mount, also known as Captain Christopher Pike, reading Theodore Sturgeon. Want something a little more up-to-date? Jennifer R. Donahue's Surveillance Fatigue has you covered. In every sense. From classic space opera to intimate character drama, from heroic alien pets waiting for their families, to herds of literal Einsteins and the benevolent conspiracy they're hatching, Escape Pod has it all at escapepod.org. So buckle up, because it's story time.
Hey guys, this is Arjun Gupta from Sci-Fi's The Magician. You are listening to Slice of Sci-Fi.
I am a huge fan of the Sequart books. Their mission to more deeply explore sequential art from a academic and critical perspective. And the books they have put out over the years have been intriguing to me. The first one I came across was the Green Arrow book, and then the Daredevil book, yay. And this Musing on Monsters is fascinating to me because it goes a little bit outside of the scope of just comics. But it still falls well within the realm of pop culture, pop entertainment, and the Constantine book, which I did not know about until right before Christmas, is something I'm going to enjoy studying for a while. And I have to applaud Rich and Lou for all the work they put in multiple volumes. They did the Battlestar Galactica book a couple of years ago that I absolutely adored. Would have loved to have contributed to that one, but c'est la vie. But anyway, head on over to sequart.org and look for the existing volumes they have. Maybe you'll find something that you will enjoy. But do you have any questions or comments on comics coverage? What sort of information do you look for beyond the covers of your favorite graphic novels? Let me know. Send me an email with your questions and comments. Summer@sliceofscifi.com. You can listen to Slice of Sci-Fi on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Player FM, iHeartRadio. And if you're listening on Apple or on Stitcher, leave us a review. Let people know that you are enjoying the show. And maybe they should check it out for themselves. You can follow us on Twitter @SliceofSciFi. You can find us on YouTube or Slice of Sci-Fi there. And of course, there's the website, sliceofscifi.com. Come on by, leave your own opinions and comments on any of our interviews, any of our reviews. Enjoy yourself there by starting up a geeky conversation, because as all geeks, we need to discuss things way, way beyond the usual discussions. We argue, we debate, we pontificate. I'd like to thank everyone who is helping support the efforts here at Slice of Sci-Fi and across the other podcasts and websites in the Slice of Sci-Fi universe, including Writers After Dark and Babylon Podcast. If you are new to Babylon 5 and are just starting to get into the show, now that it's on HBO Max with its remastered deliciousness, head on over to BabylonPodcast.com and check out the various interviews and episode commentaries, episode discussions that Tim Callender and myself got into. There's a lot of years of love put into that podcast. And now that Babylon 5 is back on the air where people can see it, or streaming rather, I hope you'll stop by and check out many of the interviews we've done over the years. And yes, we still do answer questions there. And if you're interested, start up a conversation on Twitter. That Twitter account is @BabylonPodcast. But as I said, all of your donations, all of your pledges help keep all of this good stuff online. So if you would like to help out, the place to go is patreon.com/sliceofsci-fi. All of your donations do help keep these sites, these podcasts online. So thank you everyone who is currently pledging their support. And if you are pledging through Patreon, you would be eligible to get perks. Some of the stuff that I get here at Slice of Sci-Fi and Writers After Dark to review and comment on and prepare for interviews, I can't keep all of it. I just don't have the space. So supporters get first dibs. Every month I pull someone's name out of the Patreon hat, and that person gets to choose a DVD, a Blu-ray, a 4K disc, a book from the selection available here. And that's my thanks to you for helping me keep all this stuff online. And if you'd like to help out every now and then, instead of pledging every month, the link to use is paypal.me/sci-fi-summer. That'll do it for this episode. Thank you all for listening. We will be back with more Slice of Sci-Fi next week. Take care.